session number 22083-7.
This is the fourth reel of a taped interview with Bill Mitchell in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 5th of the 4th, 2001, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. We were talking last time about your coming to the desert and seeing other troops come back, and that you weren't possibly as well disguised as you had hoped you might be.
No, that's right. At one occasion when we pulled up, there was a train headed the other way, and it was stationary, and we could tell they were Australians because of the accent. And they were chiacking us about going down when they were going back, and...
What sort of things were they saying?
I can't actually recall now, but it's sort of along the lines, well, you'll be sorry sort of thing that you're going down there. And we knew that they were Australians because of the accent. And evidently they were Australian Air Force.
Something about the boots too.
Oh, yes. They took all our Australian identity off us, our colour patches, slouch hats, and left us with our red boots. And we're the only troops in the world with red boots, I think.
How did it feel with the other troops sort of having a go at you about going west while they were going east?
Well, we knew they were just, it was a bit of banter as far as they were concerned. They knew what was going on, even if we weren't fully aware of the situation at the time.
But what was the sense of urgency?
Well, it must have been pretty urgent, because when we went through Alamein, not through Alamein, went past Alexandria. We went on for about, I think it was about 10 miles out of Alexandria, and we were put into positions that had already been dug, that had been filled up with sand, and we had to clean them out. And then when we cleaned them out, along came the artillery with their 25-pounders, and they were putting them in between our positions, and they were going to be used as anti-tank guns, because we helped the artillerymen to pull the guns into position. So things must have been looking pretty bad up at the front when they were going to do that, to use the 25-pounders as anti-tank guns, because our 2-pounder anti-tank guns were as good as useless against the heavy German tanks.
Can you mentioned the trenches that were already dug, or the positions that were dug, filled in with sand. Can you describe the actual lay of the country?
As far as I can remember, it was sand dunes, something like the beach. It was fairly flat, you could see for miles. I don't think I'm just trying to recall now exactly what it was, but I know we were only there for a matter of, we'd no sooner got them cleaned out than we were shifted on. Within 2 or 3 days we were then taken further forward, just outside of Alamein. And
what did you understand of the importance of Alamein?
Well, we were told that it was a narrow neck, a narrow section where, with the sea on one side and the Katara depression on the on our left. And it, we were told that no tanks could get through the Katara depression, so and I guess that turned out to be exactly what did happen. And we were, I think the Australian contingent was spread over well, something like a 20-30 mile front. I'm not too sure about that either, but I know it was fairly short, like the front wasn't very wide. And we were dug in there on one occasion, and I think the mate and I must have found the only soft part of the Western Desert, because we dug a hole approximately 4 foot deep without striking any rock, and it probably would have been the only one that was ever dug there. And we went down and set up our Bren gun there, but we never had a fight out of it. We used to go out on patrol, and on the night of the 22nd, that would be the night of the 21st into the 22nd, we were sent out on a listening post, and we had the privilege of seeing the an attack by the Royal Navy. Their planes come in and they were bombarding the Italian artillery positions, and we could actually see them running, you know, like they run from one place to another. And the planes had dropped flares, and then the others had come in and dropped their bombs. And while we were out there, we were supposed to go out until daylight and then come back. And it was about 2 o'clock in the morning. A runner came out and said, "You've got to come back and be ready to go in with the second 32nd in the morning at dawn," which we did do. And when we got back into our original line, there was a young stretcher bearer, Jimmy Jones, his name was, and he'd just been issued with a brand new first aid kit. And when he got back, he said, "Oh," he said, "I've left my first aid kit out there." And with that, he went out on his own, and must have been at least 2,000 yards. He went out and found his first aid kit, came back, and he was the only stretcher bearer that was right on the job when we were doing our attack.
Tell us what the feeling was like, knowing that you were about to be involved in an attack that wasn't just a patrol.
No, well, we knew it was going to be a full-scale attack because, as I said, we went in with the 32nd Battalion. I'm just trying to gather my thoughts. Yeah, well, I don't think there was very much time to think about anything. Everything was done in such a hurry. We were to line up the engineers had put a starting tape down, and we lined up on the tape, and we were given the instructions that when the barrage went over, that it would gradually creep, and we were to more or less lean on it so that you could get right in close to the positions before the enemy could poke his head out.
You mentioned that on the patrol of the 21st that you had seen the artillery posts being bombed. Did you understand what you might be up against?
No. Well, we... well, at that stage, I'd never ever come under a really heavy attack before, except the for the one occasion in Tobruk when I when we were shelled out of the Arab village. I don't think anybody realised that the artillery barrage would be so intense as it was.
Tell us about what it was like to be involved with a creeping artillery barrage.
Well, there was a certain time set that the artillery would pound the positions of the enemy, and then they would gradually they dropped their shells just in front of us, and I think they always estimated that there'd be a certain amount of casualties from our own barrage. You had to get in very close to get the element of surprise, I suppose. And I don't know whether any of our fellows were actually wounded or killed by our own artillery, but I know that when we got close, the artillery, the barrage lifted, and then it was on for young and old.
What were your immediate officers instructing you to do?
Well, the last thing I can remember, Jock Cameron, he was our platoon officer, he said, charge number 8. We were number 8 platoon. And that's the last I ever saw of him. He was killed a bit later on.
How had your training assisted you in this situation, a real life attack?
Oh, I think it was stood us in good stead, because we did things automatically, you know. We were told that when we started off that if one of our men was hit or wounded, we were to just ignore him and keep on going, because the stretcher bearers were supposed to look after them. Well, my number 2, he was carrying... he had 12 magazines besides his rifle and his ammunition, and I saw him go down, and I suppose I just kept going, and I called the bloke on my left to come in and act as my number 2. Well, I finished up running out of ammunition because the other 12 magazines were on the original number 2, and I wanted the number 2 to reload some of the empties, because we were carrying bandoliers of ammunition, and he said you load them, and he said, and I'll keep watch out the front. So I was loading the magazine when I got wounded in the elbow, and
before you were wounded, what was the feeling of seeing your number 2 go down?
Oh, well, as I said, I just kept going, because that was our orders, not to stop. And it wasn't long after that the platoon corporal went down. They were both wounded, but the number 2, he was the bloke that I remained friends with right up till his death, which was last year, he, people won't believe this, but he had a rabbit's foot on his dog tags, and a bullet hit the rabbit's foot and diverted it round his ribs, and I saw a big cloud of smoke come out of his back, so it must have been an explosive bullet, and I it went through my mind then that how he was gone, but luckily he got out of it. And
what was, you mentioned the creeping barrage moving forward, what was the intensity of return fire?
Oh, well, they threw everything at us. There was .88s and mortars. The 88 millimetre gun was probably the worst or the most deadly gun of the lot. They'd explode up in the air about, I suppose it'd be about 20-30 feet, it might have been a bit more, and then they'd spread out, and you could see the white hot metal flying around everywhere. So, and I think that's what won the situation for us, where we were getting in very close, and our platoon sergeant, he rushed at a 88 gun, swung it round on them, and it was then that they caved in. So they must have known what was on the end of the 88s. And
how does one keep going in a situation where you're being surrounded by shrapnel, by mortar bombs?
Well, I don't know. I suppose we're all mad. But, we just kept on going, and that was it until, as I say, I ran out of ammunition and started loading the Bren gun magazines that I had, and the number two that I had, then he wanted to go back and see if he could find the original number two, but I thought that was a bit hazardous.
To what degree are you oblivious to what's going on around you?
I think you are. I think you're just more or less unconscious or semi-conscious. Because different fellows that I talked to, they said, can you remember exactly what went on? And I said, no. It took me at least 5 months before I could piece together exactly what did happen. And when I got wounded in the elbow here, my number two was on my left, and he came round and he was going to put a field dressing on it. And he was there, and I'm here. And I got my elbow up like that, and he's putting the bandage on it, and then a mortar landed behind us. And I don't know how it happened, but he lost his left eye, and I got hit in the ribs just here, and the bit of metal skidded off my rib, hit the point of my shoulder blade, and come out under my arm. So I was extremely lucky. If it had been an eighth of an inch either way, well, would have gone right through me. So, but as I said, I'm a bit of a fatalist, because an old digger from the First War, he said, he used to say to me, the man that was born to be hung will never die otherwise. And I'm a firm believer in that, and I do to this day. Think so, because I think your future's mapped out, and what's going to happen will happen, and you can't do a damn thing about it. And eventually, as I said, the platoon sergeant swung the gun around, and of course, these the opposition put their hands up, And it turned out to be ex-paratroopers from Crete. And there was 150 of them, and 30 of our blokes took them prisoner. They evidently didn't want to carry on fighting.
We're talking about the attack at Ruisat Ridge of the 22nd of July, 1942. You spoke earlier on about being badly smashed up. Could you describe the placements? You were part of which platoon going forward?
I was in 8th platoon, and 7th platoon was on our left, and 9th platoon was in reserve. And just before the fighting finished, a couple of chaps from the 9th platoon came over to give us a hand, and a couple of them got killed. So.
And you have been doing a few sums to work out the casualty rate in that particular...
Yeah, well, that's official out of our book on the 2nd 43rd. There was 13 killed and 25 wounded, which made 38 out of a total of what's three platoons? What we work it out to be about 44, 45 men, and that left six.
So 45 in the two platoons going the front platoon.
Yeah, they were the spearhead, and out of that, there was 13 killed and 25 wounded, which made the six walk out of the two platoons.
Were you anywhere around when the German prisoners were taken?
Oh, yes. I was quite close to them. I was looking at them, and they had their hands up, and one fellow wanted to carry a tin of water, and because evidently they were very short of water. And I can still see Bluey Jones. He give him a prod with the bone, and he says, "Get him up and leave that can here. We've got plenty of water." And it was then that they put down a barrage, and they didn't care whether they killed their own blokes or us or anybody.
You mentioned that they didn't have much water. What sort of physical condition were they in?
Oh, what I can remember, they looked all right. They must have been down there pretty tough, though, because their lines were stretched out. And I often wonder whether it was a bit of the strategy to let them get that far and stretch their lines out and then slip into them. But it nearly come unstuck. Because if we hadn't won that first battle of Alamein, there would have been no second battle of Alamein. It would have been somewhere else.
Well, you were talking. It did help the turnaround, even though you were badly smashed up.
Oh yes, yeah. they took that position and held it. What happened after that, I don't know, because I wasn't there.
What were your feelings on having been wounded? What sort of pain were you in?
Very little, actually. I think I was numbed. You know, the first one on my elbow took a chunk out. I suppose you could almost put your fist in it, and that sort of numbed the whole of my arm. And when I got hit in the ribs at the back, it was just like getting a thump. And after that, there was not much pain at all until back in hospital. The wound wouldn't heal up.
What was it like being out there, realising that you were wounded in that situation?
Well, I felt pretty confident that the once I saw the prisoners being taken, that it wouldn't be long before the stretcher bearers came in and picked me up. But I said to my number two that had lost his eye, and the stretcher bearers had come in and bandaged him up. And then they left us and went on to somebody else. And he couldn't see, and I couldn't help him. So I said, well, I must have been mad at the time, or delirious or something. I said, I'll go and see if I can find somebody to come back and give you a hand in. So I went, and the next thing I know, other blokes from 9th platoon singing out, get down, get down. And I flopped into a slip trench, and I was there until they came and lifted me out and took me back and put me in an ambulance.
You mentioned earlier on that there was that time when you were concerned what they might do with the wounded. What were you being told, what experience had you of how the wounded were treated by the enemy?
I shouldn't have had any worries whatsoever with the Germans, because they treated our blokes in that had been taken into Brook, they treated them very well. But up to that point, none of our blokes had, or very few of them had been taken prisoners. I don't think there had been any up to that point. And I think that had we been taken prisoner, they'd have looked after us just the same as they looked after their own. I couldn't say the same for the Italians, because I heard later that they left one of our fellows on the side of the road badly wounded, and of course when the advance went through, they picked him up and got him back. He got back to Australia and lived. So I think that they'd have looked after us just as good as they did.
What were your thoughts on waiting to be picked up? You are lying in the trench, wounded. Did you know the seriousness of your wounds?
No. I knew I'd been. I couldn't. My arm just flopped. You know, I couldn't use my arm. But what had happened to me back, I didn't know. I never had a clue, because I couldn't see it. But it must have looked pretty gruesome, because even months after, when I got on the ship, and I was getting a dress, and one of the VADs on board the ship, she walked in the door, and I heard her gasp, so it couldn't have looked too good.
Tell us about being picked up.
Yeah, well, a couple of blokes out of 9th platoon picked me up and took me back behind the line. And a fellow by the name of Stan Casehagen was one. I can't remember who the other one was. Because Casehagen is a German name. Our battalion was full of German descendants. There was Saddles and Schultz and Schutz and Banzimers and Liebenecks.
What were their feelings toward fighting Germans?
They didn't worry them. They were as good a soldier as any of the others. Probably better in a lot of cases.
Why do you think?
Well, I don't know. They just built that way. Our platoon corporal was a German descendant, and he had a brother. His name was Schutz. And we had Heitmans, and two brother Heitmans. And then they were, I think they were about the only two that got out intact, that without being split up.